against maybe Commonwealth Edison.
Again.
Mr. Newman.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel, my name is Glenn Newman, and I do represent Commonwealth Edison Company here today.
Commonwealth Edison is the right party here?
It is, Your Honor. Commonwealth Edison was the sponsor of the plans at issue and remained the sponsors. Mr. Beach retired from Commonwealth Edison in 1997.
But it remains the sponsor. That's the critical question. This is an unfunded plan, so it's a suit against the sponsor rather than the plan.
That's right. Commonwealth Edison is the legal entity that maintains the plan. Your Honor, in essence, this case is about the limits of the fiduciary obligations imposed by ERISA. Specifically, this case addresses whether an employer can be a fiduciary of a plan that does not yet exist and has not been contemplated by the employer in any fashion. It also addresses whether an employer's fiduciary status and liability is determined by reference to the particular plan at issue or can be determined by reference to some other unspecified and wholly unrelated plan.
Well, you were a little picky on this for my taste, because it was clear from your own submissions that Mr. Beach was a participant in a pension plan sponsored by Commonwealth Edison. I mean, there's a plan out there. Now, whether that plan has anything whatever to do with this particular welfare plan, the voluntary severance package, I certainly recognize to be another question, but I thought you overstated your point rather considerably when you suggested what plan. You know, we don't have any plans. You know, there are plans out there, and he was a participant in one, but I suppose the question is the relation between the pension plan and the VSP anything like the relation between the two plans at issue, for instance, in the Verity case, where, again, there were two plans and the employer was there saying, you can leave plan number one because plan number two is so great. Obviously, a somewhat different situation.
Yeah, we think Verity, a couple of points you raised, Your Honor. We think Verity is very distinguishable because in that case, the employer was admittedly the fiduciary and administrator of the Verity plans at issue. And there, the officers of Verity brought the employees into a room, and essentially, if you take the Supreme Court's reading of the facts, lied to them about, in order to induce them to leave their vested benefits under the existing Verity plans, for which those officers were fiduciaries and administrators, and then go to another plan that for a subsidiary that was insolvent, knowing that they would likely lose all of their benefits. The officers knew that. But the question before the court in Verity was when the admitted fiduciary did that, were they acting in their fiduciary capacity or only in their employer capacity? And the Supreme Court determined that they were acting in their employer capacity. Now, Mr. Beach points to the retirement plan, and Your Honor is right. There is a retirement plan, but there are a couple points about the retirement plan. Not to be overly technical about it, but there is no evidence in the record that
it's not clear that it's possible in ERISA cases to be overly technical.
So I found, Your Honor. But there is no evidence in the record that ComEd was the fiduciary or the administrator of the pension plan at issue. And even if ComEd was a fiduciary of the pension plan, ERISA is very explicit that each plan is its own separate legal entity. So therefore, it has to file its own annual reports with the Department of Labor, have its own written plan descriptions. It names its own fiduciaries. And more importantly, the fiduciary status is plan specific. ERISA defines a fiduciary by saying that it's a person who exercises discretionary authority or control with respect to the particular plan. And here, the statements about the potential voluntary severance plan had absolutely no impact on Mr. Beach's retirement benefit. The plans are wholly unrelated.
Could I ask you whether if, I recognize that your position is that there was no serious consideration in the technical sense of that term of the voluntary severance package until at least roughly a month after Mr. Beach retired. But at the moment that we hit that serious consideration point, would you say that there is at that point some level of fiduciary duty on the part of the putative sponsor of this new plan toward people who might be involved?
No, Your Honor, we would not. We don't think it is necessary for this court to reach the materiality or serious consideration arguments that have been extensively briefed to resolve this case. ERISA is very specific that a welfare plan is, quote, a plan that has been established or maintained by an employer, and that a fiduciary is a person who exercises discretionary authority.
No, not really getting at the question. It's a question that concerns me, too. Not the question is not do we have to reach it if we accept your other arguments. We're trying to figure out what your view is. If, let us say, serious consideration of an early retirement plan at Division X begins on Monday, and on Wednesday the staff says there's no possibility that such a plan will ever be adopted, on Thursday the person retires, and on Friday the plan is publicly announced. What happens in such a circumstance?
Your Honor, if what we are talking about is an early retirement plan, that would be an amendment to an existing established plan.
Well, I mean, if you could assume it's the exact voluntary severance package involved here. I mean, I'm trying to get at the same thing Judge Easterbrook is talking about.
We will stipulate that it is a voluntary severance package that is a distinct plan because it is an ERISA welfare benefit plan and not a pension benefit plan. My hypothetical concerns a welfare benefit plan.
Okay. Our position would be that until that plan is established, there is no fiduciary obligation.
So you think the employer can lie through its teeth to the employees on 2 days after serious consideration begins, and there's absolutely no fiduciary consequence to that. There's no relationship between the employer and this employee who relies to his detriment on the lie and retires on Thursday.
Not under ERISA. The employee could have a claim for fraud or any other number of things, but
I assure you that if you filed a state law fraud claim, you would move it to federal court and say it was completely preempted by ERISA. Would you not?
Of course you would, because it would be.
Not unless there's an established plan. We think that ERISA's fiduciary obligations attach.
I would say it's preempted by ERISA because it concerns the impending establishment of a plan, and the benefit claimed is a benefit under the plan. I can write your brief for you if you'd like. It wouldn't take much time.
Nonetheless, our position, Your Honor, is that fiduciary obligations attach to the point a plan is established. Now, what you're talking about is deliberate deceit and misrepresentation, and I want to make absolutely clear, in this case, there's absolutely no evidence of any kind of deceit whatsoever. Nobody at Commonwealth Edison knowingly misled Mr. Beach. That's undisputed.
There's a separate problem always in these cases about who knows what. Right? At any substantial organization, people don't know everything. But in order to figure out what happens with that subset of human resources people, who you keep referring to as ministerial employees, and mystery to me, I would have thought of them as employees with ministerial duties. Ministerial employees are people who work at, say, a ministry in a cabinet system of government. Anyway, we need to figure out what happens if the person doing the lying is the person who has just signed off on the plan. Right? The corporate vice president on Monday drafts the terms of the plan, puts them in his computer. He plans to sign it and announce it on Friday. On Wednesday, he lies about it. All one person, all one plan, right? We need to know the answer to that, and then we can figure out whether it's different if the person who tells the story is ignorant of the truth.
Again, Your Honor, it's our position that fiduciary obligations, ERISA claims, arise at the time the plan is established. But this court has also repeatedly...
The problem with that strict view is that it almost means that if we were to disagree with you on that, what's to say we wouldn't equate the corporate vice president who drafts the plan and has it in his computer with the lower down level person in the human resources department who says, gee, you know, I don't think they'd ever adopt a plan like that, in all innocence, you know, which of course is what you say happened in this instance. The people to whom Mr. Beach was talking were perhaps ill-informed, but they weren't evil, you know, they weren't deliberately misleading. But the question is there a difference between, you know, does that state of mind matter? Your opponents say it doesn't matter. Your opponents say this is all about liability of the sponsor of the plan anyway, and it can't hide behind some Chinese wall or behind some veil of ignorance.
There's an important point to be made there, though, Your Honor. And this is not a case where corporate officers were considering whether or not to establish a plan or whether there was some consideration of the plan underway and were trying to determine the point at which liability attaches. Here, it's absolutely undisputed that no one, no officer, no employee of the company had any idea they were going to establish the voluntary severance plan at issue here when Mr. Beach retired. The first time anyone thought about that was when about 6 weeks after Mr. Beach retired. Mr. Beach points to a report prepared by the auditors or consultants in October, the following October after Mr. Beach retired in June, and it has a lot of attachments as part of the record. There's one document in there that he relies on that actually is dated 3 days after Mr. Beach retired, in which it's identified that there may be 30 excess employees out of 4,700 total employees in the company. That's it. That's all we know at the time Mr. Beach retired. From that, they're making the leap that, somehow we are shielding the HR people from the fact that, based on the fact that there are 30 excess employees, that Commonwealth Edison has never, in this division of 4,700 employees, has never offered a VSP, that the evidence is undisputed that there were a number of other possibilities ComEd would pursue, including transferring employees to other areas of the department when it had excess employees, that somehow those HR people should have known that, well, in this case, we're going to offer the first voluntary severance plan in our history, even though there are only 30 excess employees. We're going to do that, first think about it, 6 weeks from now, that the voluntary severance plan would be available to 240 out of the 4,700 people at Commonwealth Edison, and that one of them would be Mr. Beach. I mean, there is no shielding here. There is no fact floating around that the HR people were ignorant of. In fact, ComEd went beyond its obligations when it circulated a memo saying it was considering a department reorganization, which is an employer act. It's not required to disclose. But nonetheless, they disclosed that. So there is full disclosure here. It just so happened that Mr. Beach retired at the unfortunate time that shortly after he retired, a voluntary severance plan came up. That always is going to happen. Someone is always going to miss. But Commonwealth Edison is not responsible as a fiduciary under ERISA for that fact. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Newman. Mr. McCausher.
May it please the Court, I'm Thomas McCausher, and I represent the plaintiff appellee, Mr. Beach. To address the last thing that counsel said, the Court should make no mistake about what we're claiming should have been done here. We don't claim that they were in a position or had any obligation to tell Mr. Beach that a plan was going to be offered. That's not the issue here. Our position is that even if the company in that situation didn't have the obligation to give him complete and accurate information as to what was going on at the time, surely the company had the obligation to not give him categorically false information concerning the present facts as they then stood.
But what reason is there to believe on this record that if every time he had spoken to one of the human resources people, instead of saying what they said, they had just said, I have no idea,
which,
as far as you're concerned, would have been perfectly legal?
I think you'd have a different situation. I think it still has to be, because I believe you look at the totality of the circumstances, the way this Court said you do in Bowerman. And, you know, the circumstances might still make that misleading in the sense
I have no idea if the human resources people, in fact, were not in the loop for what was going to happen in July.
Well, if the question is, are you going to offer a package? that probably would be perfectly okay. If the question is there anything going on, is there a possibility of a package, you might argue that they could say, well, there's a reorganization going on, and there's no way to know what's going to happen. That would be a perfectly honest answer, too. But that's not what was said. What was said here is, first of all, nothing's going on, and above all, it's essentially what's suggested is it was decided that your department is not going to get a package. And this is what they admit is uncontradicted in the record, that Mr. Beach was repeatedly told that they weren't considering it and that specifically the T&D department would not be included in any kind of package. That's at page supplemental appendix 11. And not only that, each of these individuals promised to update him if anything changed. So the real issue was there any possibility that such a thing would happen, which is what Mr. Beach asked about. And what they told him was, no, it's impossible, it will not happen, which to a reasonable hearer, and this is the real issue, what would a reasonable hearer think under those circumstances? A reasonable hearer would think, well, they're telling me it's not going to happen, this department's not going to get it. When it's unqualified in that way, the reasonable hearer thinks, well, a decision's been made against it, I guess it's okay for me to leave. And that's really what's at issue in this specific case. It's this unqualified, categorical, specific assurance that a reasonable hearer would mean that they've ruled it out.
I'm puzzled about how anybody can think that assurances about the future never change. Right? The Senate Majority Leader gets up and says, Package X just isn't going to pass. And as a result, large businesses make financial commitments, and a week later it passes. It happens all the time. Why wouldn't people understand this happens in any large organization?
I completely agree that that does happen. And in fact, the Ballone case that said that where, let's say, a person had said, this company will never offer a package again. The courts have held that when you start using language like that, the reasonable hearer would think, oh, come on, that can't be something I can rely on because never, you know, is simply too broad and sweeping. But when you tell somebody about the present state of affairs, and
yeah, but that's the problem. All it can possibly mean is our current intention is not to do this. But apparently, it's agreed on this record that that was their current intention not to do it, and then they changed their mind.
Oh, that's not agreed on the record. What's agreed on the record is he was told that it would not happen to his department. And Mr. Beach reasonably took that to mean that a decision had been made in the present time to not offer it to that department. And there certainly had been no decision against a package for that department when Mr. Beach left. And in fact, it was on June 4th, several weeks before Mr. Beach's retirement became effective, that they in fact finalized the planning that showed that they were going to have excess personnel. And they'd offered 20 or 30 of these packages in a row every time they realized they had excess personnel.
I ask you whether you think employees would be better off with the implication of your position, which is I think any corporate employer would issue instructions to the human resources staff that they are never under any circumstances to make any predictions, judgments, or assessments about what is likely to happen in the future. The only thing they can do is hand out copies of the current summary plan descriptions.
Well,
anything further is a dischargeable offense.
Well, I don't think that these departments should be in the position of opining, predicting, giving opinions about what will happen in the future.
Why do you think corporate employees would be better off if they were disabled, which is really the implication of your position, from making predictions? Knowing that something is a 70% chance may be better than just having no information at all.
But predictions have to be seen as just that. They're predictions. Statements of present fact.
Well, President Eisenhower said that all predictions are chancy, especially those about the future.
Well, I just want to make it absolutely clear, Your Honor, I am not arguing that they had any obligation to make predictions. And above all,
You may not be getting my question. If your position wins today, there will be a directive from corporate HQ at Commonwealth Edison. No predictions, period. The question is, will that make employees better off or worse off? There is some set of cases where the predictions will be wrong, but one would assume, I think, a somewhat larger set where the predictions will be right. are the employees made better off by being disabled from receiving predictions that, on average, are apt to be correct?
Well, I don't think they would be better off. I guess to specifically answer your question, I don't think they would be better off. But the issue is not about predictions that talk about what might happen in the future. It's predictions that misrepresent present facts. The present fact at issue here is whether the company had decided not to offer one for the department. That's just a fact. They had
already. Why is that fact not subject to reopening? I mean, I think I'm not sure if this is a semantic debate or not, but one could come to a decision on, you know, April 16th that you're not going to have a particular kind of plan, and then on June 25th, when you see what the numbers look like, you know, it's 30 excess positions, not 5, or, you know, it's 100 excess positions, not 30. You know, there's a process of revision that goes on, so an earlier decision gets set aside. This court grants petitions for rehearing sometimes. You know, we come out with very formal decisions that we then change. So I
think it happens all the time, and had that been an accurate statement of the then existing facts?
Well, what if it was? Suppose it was absolutely accurate. They had no intention of a VSP in this department, and then 3 days later, you know, they discover it's 30 excess positions after he retires, that is, and then they look at it further and they say, you know, we're really going to need to do this. We're just not going to be able to take care of these 30 people through these other mechanisms that Mr. Nelson testified about, whether transfer or what have you.
See, I think under these facts, had the company specifically decided not to make an offer to that department, had they decided that and then changed their mind later, there might not be a liability here. What the liability hinges on here is the fact that that was a false statement.
Why is that different in the end? Even if it was still up in the air, I think on this record it would be very hard to say that they had affirmatively decided in favor of the VSP at that point. I think it was up in the air. So we're talking about the difference between the most accurate thing, if you got all of the key players in the room, the most accurate thing would be, we're not sure what we're going to do. We need more data. Instead, Mr. Beach hears it has been decided that we are not going to do X. But one way or the other, if you agree that that second statement is subject to reopening, why isn't he in the same position?
Well, because the question is, you have to start first whether they gave him accurate information. They gave him false information. They told him, essentially, that it had been decided that they would not offer a package. Had that been correct information, and then it changed later, the company did not misrepresent present facts.
And why, maybe you should address, actually, Mr. Newman's argument. Why, vis-a-vis this VSP, which was not under serious consideration, I think even you agree, until the July meeting that takes place, July 23rd or sometime like that, why does Commonwealth Edison have kind of a pre-planned fiduciary obligation toward Mr. Beach?
It is, in our opinion, Your Honor, because of the existing fiduciary relationship.
Because of his pension plan?
Well, because they were fiduciaries of not only the pension plan, but of all the benefit plans that Mr. Beach was covered for.
So why did, when is he there went, any evidence that he gave up a benefit under one plan that Commonwealth Edison was running so that he would get some other benefit, which is really the Verity pattern?
Yeah. There were two things here that were involved in addition to pension enhancement, a potential pension enhancement. One was health insurance, one was life insurance. Mr. Beach gave up his health insurance under the Commonwealth Edison plan, and what he was told was that if he retired, he's not going to get health insurance benefits. He had a sick wife, he needed the health insurance benefits, and in that scenario, he did give up his health insurance benefits because he believed if he retired, he couldn't get any better ones.
But not because he thought he was going to get another plan. That's the missing.
It was because he believed that he would not get the benefit of a special package, which would include health care.
I understand that, but I guess I'm having trouble putting it in this. You know, you want Commonwealth Edison's fiduciary relationship vis-a-vis Mr. Beach for all these other plans to carry over to this inchoate, you know, non-plan. And I'm not sure about when that arises. Perhaps it's a serious consideration point. Perhaps, you know, Mr. Newman's taking the tough line, saying not until the plans, you know, got a seal on it. But in any event, after Mr. Beach retired, is the only thing we can say here. So why is there a fiduciary relationship vis-a-vis this new plan?
Because of the fiduciary, if I can finish, I realize my time's up.
That's not quite.
My time's up. It's the existing fiduciary relationship and whether the question involved, and this is the way Verity looks at it, does the question involved go to the essence of the relationship in which there's a fiduciary duty about employee benefits?
But Commonwealth Edison was doing exactly what it said it would do vis-a-vis the other plans. Namely, it gave him his pension plan, it terminated the health benefits. You know, it didn't change an iota of the other plans.
Well, it did, because...
No, it didn't.
I mean, there is an element of the other plan.
It was doing exactly the same thing under those other plans that it would have been doing if this VSC had never come into being.
All I'm saying, Your Honor, is that there was an element of the existing plans that were implicated by the change that would have happened if the VSP came. And that
they would have, yeah, he would have had a different
clearly
plan.
The health care benefits. In other words, if he could have gotten health care benefits, they are a fiduciary with respect to health care benefits. And if he could have gotten health care benefits by staying and getting the VSP, well, again, that goes to the essence of the question of health care benefits. And the lump sum VSP benefits go to the essence of what he would have gotten at retirement. So the real question is it within the subject matter of the fiduciary relationship? If you parse it too fine, they could simply manipulate it, as they argue that they can, between new and revised plans. What if, for instance, in this case, they had simply amended the retirement plan to include this extra lump sum and to grant the extra health care and the other benefits? In that case, clearly, it would be on the same subject. It would clearly be a continuing fiduciary relationship. I just don't think that the court would want to leave it to the employer to simply label something new or a separate plan and thereby escape its fiduciary duties.
But what about the point that ERISA plans are each regarded as independent plans?
They may be regarded as independent plans, but that does not mean a person with an existing fiduciary relationship and an ongoing fiduciary relationship can mislead a person regarding things that are within their control. And if the thing within their control is to create a new separate plan versus, you know, amending an existing plan, and this court holds that just by going down one path or the other that you can avoid fiduciary duties, well, obviously, they're just going to start labeling all of these things new plans. And that has been considered by the courts, and specifically the Verity case involved a totally separate, totally new plan. And the Verity court held that because of their existing fiduciary relationship under the old plan, they had liability. Same thing in Balloon.
Suppose ComEd, in its employee handbook or some other matter like that, had simply placed a statement that had said that the Department of Human Resources personnel are not authorized to make statements on behalf of the corporation about possible amendments to the corporation's welfare plans, and that employees are cautioned not to rely on such statements in planning their future. If that statement had appeared in the ComEd employee handbook, would you have a case?
Under some of the case law, Your Honor, I would not. Clearly, I would not. Under my view of what the correct duty of a fiduciary is, I don't think you can just write into the plan that our fiduciary duty ends at a certain point and get away with it, but I think Your Honor could find some case law to support that position.
And in that case, we probably wouldn't be here today, would we, if ComEd had done that?
Under some of the case law, Your Honor, that's correct. Under what I believe is the correct view, I don't think they can just write themselves out of a fiduciary duty at that point.
They can caution you, can they not, as to who a fiduciary can caution you as to exactly who speaks for the fiduciary.
And they should, Your Honor. I think in lots of cases, for instance, there's ambiguity about whether, can I ask my supervisor, can I ask this low-level HR person this question? I think companies would do themselves and everybody a favor by saying, look, if you have a question about the future of our plans, ask this person and not all these other people. And that way they can control the flow of information.
You've been helpful. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Newman?
Thanks, Your Honor. Just a few points.
Mr. Newman, why doesn't ComEd have a statement like that in its employee handbook? why don't you just tell your employees straight up who speaks for you on these matters, period?
Well, I can't answer your question as to why we don't have that statement in an employee handbook, or if one exists. I can say that at the time the plan at issue was issued in this case, once the plan was established, it had all the disclosures, the appropriate disclosures in it, and the plan did tell employees who they could rely on. But as far as the general handbook, I can't answer that question.
Thank you.
I'd like to address Your Honor's question or concern that we're taking the hard line and it's not until we put a seal on the plan. We are taking the position that fiduciary duties do not attach until a plan is established, but this court has held that for a plan to be established, it doesn't have to have a seal on it. All it has to have is that for a court to be able to determine the plan's intended beneficiaries, its source of financing, and the procedures for receiving benefits. And if to take Judge Easterbrook's example, if the board of directors had on a Monday decided we're going to have a voluntary severance plan and establish it on Wednesday, that plan's probably established at that point. So once those kind of things happen, you have an established plan and fiduciary obligations would kick in.
So would you say on the fact that this case, that's July 23rd, when they sit down there and map out at the meeting what they're going to do?
I think the people that sat down and mapped out what was going to happen in that case were some fairly low-level human resources employees, and I'm not sure that you'd actually have an established plan at that point because you wouldn't be able to determine the sources of funding and the intended beneficiaries. Once the discussion has gotten to the point where you could determine those things, yes, you would have an established plan and ERISA's fiduciary obligations would kick in. Your Honors, it's also important to note that no matter what standard, what test this court applies, serious consideration, materiality, if it gets to that point, no court in the nation has ever imposed fiduciary obligations on an employer for a benefit plan that has not been considered in any manner, contemplated in any manner by an employer at the time that the alleged misrepresentations were made. It's simply unprecedented, and an employer would be hard-pressed to administer its plan if any time it made a statement, that statement could come back at a later point when it established a plan and create the basis of a misrepresentation claim. And as this court noted in Fromm, that would lead to a situation where an employer...
Thank you, counsel.
Pardon?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is taken under advisement.